When it comes to cancer care, every decision holds tremendous weight. St. Joseph's Health has partnered with Roswell Park, the region's only nationally designated comprehensive cancer center. Now, patients have access to advanced therapies and the expertise of leading oncologists without traveling far from home. Among the many moves you can make in the battle against cancer, choosing St. Joseph's Health can change your life for the better. Learn more at sjhsyr.org/cancer.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is Smarter Collaboration, the series that explores how gutsy leaders bring diverse thinkers to the table and create breakthrough outcomes. Hosted by Harvard scholar Dr. Heidi Gardner and business executive Ivan Matviak, they lean into their experience of teaching at Harvard Law and Harvard Business Schools, authoring best-selling books on collaboration and leading teams across financial services and consumer goods sectors. Today's show takes Smarter Collaboration to outer space. Enjoy this program with NASA astronaut Major Kate Rubens. Now here's Heidi and Major Rubens exploring Smarter Collaboration at over 17,000 miles per hour.
Welcome back to Smarter Collaboration. We're celebrating Women's History Month with an American hero, Major Kate Rubens. Our guest today has flown in space twice before turning her sights on service in the U.S. Army Reserve. Among her many achievements, Major Rubens is the first person ever to sequence DNA in space and has championed cutting-edge research as a soldier. Here now during Women's History Month to talk about her work both on solid ground and up in orbit is Major Kate Rubens of the U.S. Army Reserve. Major Rubens, welcome to our program. There are so many of our listeners who wish they had become astronauts, who dreamt of it when they were kids. And I dare say my co-author and business partner, Ivan Matviak, is one of them and is quite jealous about our conversation today. So inform us, give us a sense of your background. What was your journey to becoming an astronaut?
Yeah, well, I'm really excited to be here today, too. I think my journey starts when I was a kid, you know, when I was five, like you said, like, you know, a lot of kids want to be an astronaut. I was a complete nerd, so I wanted to be an astronaut, a biologist, and a geologist, you know, and I was five, so I thought you could do all three of those things. So really, it was, you know, it was a childhood dream. But, you know, I wanted to be a biologist as well. And so when I got to high school and college, I started studying biology and I worked on viruses. And so I, you know, kind of went through that career path. And I had a research lab at MIT after getting my PhD. And I was working on a grant one day with one of my collaborators, and she was looking at jobs online. And she said, you know, I went to usajobs.gov. Can you believe it? There's applications to be astronauts online. Like, you know, kind of, isn't this ridiculous? And so we laughed. And then she's like, didn't you want to be an astronaut as a kid? And I said, well, yeah, of course. She said, you should apply. And I thought about it. And I was like, well, you know, I'm a biologist. NASA's never going to take me. So like, there's no risk here. So I applied to be an astronaut. And, you know, be careful what you apply for, because in 2009, I got the call and came down to Houston to join the 2009 astronaut class. So it's been, you know, it's been an incredible journey. I've flown in space twice. I've got a chance to participate in a variety of different, you know, scientific programs, engineering programs. You know, it's amazing to me that I could have this as a career. I'm still also a biologist, and actually, funny enough, for all the lunar work, we're starting to study geology as well.
So, I mean, that is the essence of Smarter Collaboration. Usually we're talking about different people from different disciplines collaborating together, but we've got now three people in one, in you, Major Rubens. And so you have this phenomenal ability to cross disciplines and boundaries. It's honestly, it gives me chills when I think about those moments in life where we take a small chance And then it turns into something, just, you know, it mushrooms, and all of a sudden here we are. So congratulations on taking that step. I hope you have just inspired some people to do the same. Maybe with NASA, maybe some other way. But let's dive into that idea of collaboration. I'd love to hear about an example during astronaut training where collaboration played a real crucial role in achieving some specific kind of outcome for you or your team.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of astronaut training is actually teaching us how to work in teams, and particularly multidisciplinary teams. So, you know, we are absolutely required as astronauts to be able to function as a team. We have to make sure that we understand what our crewmates are thinking, that we're able to work with them in incredibly tight and stressful situations, and that we've got kind of this level of trust and understanding. But it's not just your crewmates, it's the ground teams as well. You know, there's thousands of people on the ground that are involved in the business of space exploration. We need to be able to work with all of them. And the disciplines range, you know, from everything from we've got scientists, we've got biologists, we have people who do orbital mechanics. We have people who understand the power and the thermal system. So these are all really pretty different disciplines across science and engineering. But when you put these people together in mission control, they've got to work together and they've got to speak the same language. And so one of the ways I really remember training for this in astronaut candidate training is when we first start doing sims together, simulations. And so this is the way that astronauts train to fly in space. We've got kind of a mock-up mission control center and a mock-up capsule or spacecraft, and then a space station, and we plug all those things in together, and you have to start working together with these teams. And then, of course, you know, they're training, and the training instructors are a little bit evil, so they throw in all kinds of malfunctions. But this, it's a challenge at first. Like, things do not go very well in the first sim. But what we learn as astronaut candidates is, how are we going to move this team forward? How are we going to talk to people who've got a completely different set of training, a different way of looking at things, and make sure that we can still accomplish that mission.
So what I'm hearing is something that I talk about a lot in my research is this idea that smarter collaboration, these kinds of skills, understanding how to work with people, as you said, who speak different languages, come from such different backgrounds, it's often misleadingly called a soft skill. But without that quote unquote soft skill, you can't actually bring to bear all of that hard knowledge and technology and other kinds of aspects that are just so vital to the situation. Now, how do you get past in a situation like this where people are hardcore scientists and engineers and all of those other disciplines you mentioned? How do you get people to embrace the mindset that collaboration and teamwork isn't soft?
Yeah, it's a tough skill, I would say, maybe not a soft skill. But the thing is that these skills are trainable. You know, we know this from the literature, we know this from psychology and research, that these things, you know, some people maybe are better at naturally than others, but everybody can be trained in this. And I've really seen this also in the Army, because there, again, you've got people from really a wide variety of disciplines. Same thing, we've all got to work together under some challenging circumstances. And what I've seen in my Army training is that there's classes for this. You know, you can go to classes on communication and leadership, and you know, the Army has got to teach a lot of people how to work effectively together as a team, and they need to do this in the most efficient way possible. And so I think some of that training is actually really beneficial, because it's getting people into teams, and it's not just like sitting in the classroom training, right? I mean, some of the most important ways that you're going to do these training is in real life examples and field exercises and that kind of thing. So I think all of this is a skill that you can learn, and it's a tough skill. And so I think for anybody that's thinking, you know, I don't need to pay attention to that side, it's one of the most important things for operating in a team, is that successful ability to communicate with people, make sure your message is understood, and understand where they're coming from if they have a completely different life experience.
Wow, that last thing you said just resonates so much. I think that can often be an incredible barrier, is our maybe inadvertent but egocentric mindset, that if it's not what we've experienced, if we haven't gone through that training ourselves, if we haven't had that perspective, that it jars us. It maybe, you know, gets our back up and puts us on the defense a little bit. Why is this person coming to the table with such a different point of view? How do you personally, how do you keep your ego in check if somebody's really challenging you or says something, maybe not challenging you personally, but says something that's really jarring? How do you get yourself into the mindset of receptivity?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is important because that's everybody's natural defensive posture. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that actually really helps is to expose yourself to a situation where you really, you know, you're a fish out of water, you're doing something different, you're not in your comfort zone. You know, I don't know if I do this on purpose, but I think I do it a lot, right? I came to NASA, which is an engineering organization, as a molecular biologist, knew nothing about rocket science, right? I came into the Army, pretty far along in my career, and I'd been a civilian all my life before that. So I've been in these situations where it's really different. It could be a different culture. It could be just a different way of looking at things. And when I get into, you know, so you're already feeling a little uncomfortable, right? But when I get into those scenarios where, you know, somebody's just got a completely different way of thinking, I use curiosity a lot. So I just start to ask questions, because if you ask questions, then you're engaging with that person. It doesn't let you snap into your shell and be defensive. And it's also going to help you understand where that person's coming from. And so I asked a lot of questions my first year at NASA. I'm still asking questions in my Army unit, but I've when you start to do that and you develop relationships with people, I found people that I can connect with that I trust, that can help me out in these new situations. So I think going in, being a little bit humble and asking other people, how do they get to that point of view? Why are they thinking about that? What do they see as creative solutions to that problem?
That's brilliant. You know, some of the leaders that I work with, or aspiring leaders, people who would love to become better at this, they hesitate to take the approach you just described because they think people expect them to know it all. And they don't want to be vulnerable and show that they don't know things. Do you have advice for somebody who needs to get past that mindset?
Yeah, if you think about like the, you know, a really good conversation, right? If you're in a conversation where somebody's sort of a know-it-all and just telling you how it is and how the world works, you probably don't enjoy that conversation very much. But if you're in a conversation where somebody's, you know, asking you about what you think and your opinions and you're having that nice back and forth engagement, that's a pleasant conversation. And so I think if people think, you know, that's actually really, people look forward to that when you can engage with them at that level. And so it doesn't diminish your position of authority or your knowledge base. They're going to respect that anyway. If you come in, with a good set of credentials, or you, you're there obviously because you've been hired in that situation. But you're going to be more enjoyable to talk to if you're not coming at it from, I'm going to tell you how the world works.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you just used such a critical word, which is relationship. And when we think about collaboration, sometimes we're forced to work with people that we might not choose to have, a professional relationship with, and we need to get past that. But what I'm hearing you say, Major Rubens, is that the effort you put into developing the relationship is going to have a payout over time. Did I hear that right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. So these are not skills, as you said, that everybody naturally comes to the table with. Like you said, they are trainable. And the classroom training, those simulations, a whole variety of hands-on ways of getting people the experience is really crucial. We often hear from people that they were able to hone their collaborative skills through mentorship. I'm curious, did you have any soldiers or astronauts or others who mentored you along the way?
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking about Women's History Month, so I'll actually bring up, two female Army mentors and people who inspire me. One is Colonel Anne McLean. So she's also an astronaut. She's a colleague, and she's an active Army officer. She's a helicopter pilot. So, you know, she's flown in combat. She's been deployed multiple times. But she's also very good at leadership and connecting with people. And she's got a very good strategic mindset. So when we're talking about tough problems in the astronaut office, or, you know, where is NASA going in the future, or something related to an Army question, I'll often go to her because she's got this really great leadership perspective. And interestingly, in talking to her, she says that she acquired a lot of that through her Army work and her Army training. You know, again, this is something that really is a skill that you can learn. You know, and I've not necessarily a mentor, but kind of more of a personal hero. Lieutenant General Jody Daniels is chief of the Army Reserve. So she's in charge of the entire U.S. Army Reserve. And she's like me, she's very technical. You know, she's got degrees in math and computer science and is incredibly impressive in terms of what she's done. But she also has that ability to connect with people. So exactly like what we were talking about, you know, she is, of course, at, you know, she is at the tip of the spear. She's at the top of this organization, but she can connect to every soldier in her organization, as well as the families and the civilian support staff. And so I think that ability to connect to people who aren't just at your own level is incredible. And I just watch her as a role model.
Oh, that's fantastic. So is it people like her who inspired you to join the Army Reserve, or was there another set of inspirations for you?
Yeah, it was, you know, people like Anne, people like General Daniels. I also have had in the Army, there's quite a few Army astronauts, and my first commander on my first space flight was an Army aviator. And the chief of the office, when I came back from my first space flight, he assigned me to be the lead of the spacewalking and robotics branch. And, you know, just watching their leadership and the way that they interact with people and the way that they lead a team was incredibly inspiring. And, you know, I was just thinking about who do I want to emulate in my life? And all of those people were heroes that I really looked up to.
So let's come back to that role as an astronaut. Thank you for that response. And I just want to make sure that everyone who is desperate to learn more about what it means to be an astronaut gets their fill. We've all seen, you know, Apollo 13, everyone imagines what kind of collaborative problem solving is needed when you're in space or preparing for space. What's an instance when your team had to troubleshoot some kind of unexpected issue?
Oh, I've got a great one. on a spacewalk, we were installing a really large platform for the new solar arrays for space station, you know, which is they're going to add power. Our current solar arrays are pretty old in there. They need some augmentation. So we're building this giant, you know, platform bigger than the size of an SUV out in space. And this is the first time that we were assembling it. We were attaching it to hardware that was already in space. And so we couldn't fit check before we sent that hardware up there. And we got up there, and one of the last bolts that we were going to install, we couldn't turn it. You know, tried everything, all the tools that we had, and couldn't get it done. And we had done a bunch of work that day. We'd done enough. So we came back inside the space station, and the teams on the ground then went over to our mock-up building where we have the mock-up of the space station. They came with all the tools. I mean, it's very Apollo 13. You know, they dump a box on the table, put all these things together, and they worked, I think, for about a week straight trying to figure this out and came up with a plan. We went back outside and did another spacewalk, and I was able to use everything that they figured out in this procedure. And they didn't just have one solution. They had about five different solutions. Luckily, the first one worked. And this was super fun because it involved me taking a giant torque wrench out. And normally you have to be gentle with things on the outside of the space station. They said, no, you're allowed to put as much force into this as you want. So I was flying above the Earth at 17,500 miles an hour, and I'm allowed to like crank on this torque wrench. So the bolt finally went into place, and this whole structure snapped into place. And I'm just thinking, I wonder how many people on the ground were working on this for a week straight, but it's pretty amazing that we could do that together.
Oh my goodness. That is absolutely incredible. So did I hear you? You just, you know, brute forced your way into making this thing work at 17,000 plus miles an hour.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, sometimes you need finesse in space, and sometimes you just use some brute force and occasionally duct tape.
Well, I guess that's all part of problem solving as well. I mean, you said the T word before, trust. It's something that we talk about with almost all of our guests. It comes up spontaneously because it's just such a vital part of collaboration. So clearly, I mean, I don't think I'm overstating it if I say your life is in the hands of folks who are many, many, many moons away. And how do you develop that mutual trust? What are some of the keys? And I'm going to ask a question that you feel free not to answer, but when there's a trust breach, when something goes wrong and you do start to question whether you are right in putting full trust in somebody, how might you overcome that?
Yeah, I think one of the ways that we establish trust is by working together in teams. And small teams, I think, do the best job because people can be a little bit more open when you're in a smaller environment. And we often, in both of my jobs, we often get out there and actually experience something. So we're doing our work as a team together. So for example, when I'm, going to an Army leadership school, we're not spending much time in the classroom. We're getting together as teams and we're going out into the field and we're practicing something. I'm in the Army Medical Department. And so we're, figuring out how do you set up a field hospital? How do you safely evacuate people? What are things that we need to do to figure out how to save soldiers' lives on the front line? And so we put people kind of in these challenging circumstances. When people are not real relaxed, they've got a little bit of a challenge. Maybe they're out in the field and they're tired or cold or hungry. Automatically they become their real selves. It's kind of easy to maintain this facade in an office setting. And so my experience is that if you put these teams together and you give them a challenge and they're under some pressure, they learn how to function as a team. You have to develop that trust. If you don't, the situation breaks down and it's very reinforcing, right? You see immediately, hey, we are not getting the mission done. We've got to figure out how to communicate. And that works also for a breach of trust. Usually breach of trust is not because somebody's a bad actor. Most of the time it's a misunderstanding. And so if you still have that mission, if my unit is out in the field and we need to accomplish something to get this field hospital set up, we've got to figure out how to communicate with each other and resolve whatever misunderstanding there was that led to a breach of trust. And people will do that very effectively if they're in a small team and they've got this sense of purpose and they're very mission driven.
Fantastic. So real curiosity from a lot of people who engage with somebody who is in the military, the sense that there's so much hierarchy in the military, whether it's the US or, whichever branch. And I think what I'm hearing is that you have to be open to good ideas and great communication throughout the organization. So can you help us understand a little bit more about when hierarchy plays an effective and functional role? And when are you looking for inputs from whomever?
Yeah, I think, people say hierarchy like this is a very bad thing, but it's actually incredibly important to the Army. You need to have that structure when things are happening rapidly. You don't want to be confused about who's in charge. You don't want to be unclear about what you need to do and your role and everything. And so I think hierarchy gets sort of a bad reputation when people misuse it. I think the Army does a really good job of training people why this is important, why this structure is going to help you become more effective as a team or an organization. And that's not to say that you can't communicate among the hierarchy. And some of the best leaders, they really spend time with their soldiers. They get to know people, several ranks below them. They're checking on the health of that individual soldier or the health of the group. And those kinds of things, it's not, the hierarchy is not put in place to make some people feel better about themselves or elevate themselves over others. That is there to help everybody function and to know what their job is and how to effectively communicate. And so it can actually be a very powerful thing to have a structure that's just established. You don't have to guess at who's in charge of the project. You don't need to be trying to figure out who's got the decision-making authority. And so it can be actually quite a positive thing.
I mean, absolutely. There's a reason that hierarchy has existed, not just, in human species and social situations, but across all kinds of primates and other sorts of social environments as well. I think you're right. It does get a bad rap, but it's probably because of misuse rather than the right kind and circumstances of the applications. That makes complete sense. So I want to come back to one of the many things that you're known for, which is sequencing DNA in space. Tell us more about what you were aiming to accomplish and give us a sense of just how difficult this may have been.
Yeah, so we wanted to do a technology demonstration to see if we could even sequence DNA in space. We didn't know if this was possible. So we started the experiment. We figured something's going to go wrong, and that'll be interesting, and we'll figure out where it breaks down and then iterate and revise. The driving factor was that when we are orbiting above Earth, we don't have access to things like a hospital or a clinical lab. The way that we monitor bacteria or microbes on the space station is actually to wait until we have a vehicle that's going to deorbit from the space station and land back on Earth. And that only happens every 3 months. And so if we have an issue, you know, we need to take a blood sample from somebody or we've got a microbial problem, we're having to wait 3 months before we could even get an answer. We would streak the bacteria or take the sample. Put it in the spacecraft. It would land in the middle of Kazakhstan, and people from NASA would fly out there and pick it up and bring it back to the lab. But so we wouldn't have that result for about 4 months. And so we said, well, if we can do sequencing, you know, this is a platform technology. We can look at human health and disease. We can look at bacteria. We can look at the environmental microbiome of the spacecraft. This would be really useful. And so we flew a very small nanopore sequencer. And we sent up some DNA to sequence. And again, we thought, you know, this is gonna not work, but where it doesn't work will be interesting. It turns out it worked. I feel like science never works the first time. Almost never in my career has it worked the first time. So this is a very good experiment to have it work the first time, and it's continued to work. And so it's a platform. It allows us to continue to monitor anything that's living in a spacecraft, and that'll be really important for future exploration.
That is absolutely fascinating. And sometimes luck actually does go our way. So I suppose we should take full advantage of it when it does. Mm-hmm. So Major Rubens, let me pick up. I love what you said earlier when I came back from my first space mission. I mean, who gets to say that ever? And then throwing in the, oh, it was my first one, which means you had more than one. Why did you go into space twice? What did you learn the second time around that you weren't able to do the first?
Yeah, so we, we work for NASA, and we don't really choose when we go to space. The chief of the office chooses, and we just maintain our skills in all of these different areas, and then we get assigned a mission. And so, most people do fly in space, two, maybe three times, and we just sign up when we're called. We sign up for that mission, and so the first time, you're really figuring out how things work. It takes a long time to be adapted to the space environment. To figure out how to move, how to do experiments, you know, how to stabilize yourself. And there's this period of about maybe 2 months of really deep learning about how to function in microgravity. And so one of the neat things about flying a second mission was that I got up there and all the pathways in your brain are still there. So it's like riding a bicycle. You get back up there and you know how to move and you know how to stabilize yourself. And so you can be much more effective on your second mission. And it's also, the second mission is a chance to mentor people who are coming into that for the first time. And that's really kind of the rewarding part of the experience is to see new astronauts, get their space legs, figure out how they're going to work on the space station. People can, they fly for as long as they're medically eligible. You can fly multiple missions.
So you just mentioned mentoring people, and I think it's really important for us to be thinking about that role as mentors, all of us, especially in Women's History Month. I prefer actually to think about it as Women's Future Month and looking forward. How do we think about young kids and in honor of Women's History Month, maybe think about young girls in particular? What do you tell young girls, young women who maybe imagine becoming astronauts, but haven't even a clue what that means or where to start?
Yeah, I love your idea of Women's Future Month. You know, we've been talking about that in the Army a lot, is that, you know, we're celebrating the history, but we're also celebrating, you know, where we are currently, and we're celebrating the potential of people that are interested, you know, in joining with this career and signing up for the Army. You know, I celebrate young girls, and I do a lot with STEM education, out talking to people about what it's like to have a scientific or a technical job, or also, you know, talking to them about what it's like to be an officer in the Army. And I think the most important thing is to help people find what they're really passionate about. If you don't enjoy what you're doing, you know, every day is going to be a slog, and science, engineering, those kinds of disciplines are challenging. But if you find something that you really love, then, you know, yes, it can be hard, but you're finding joy in it. And so I encourage people, no matter what they want to do with their lives, to find something that they're very passionate about. And that passion and that excitement translates very well. If you want to go into, you know, if you want to go into service, if you want to go into a government job, if you want to go into industry, as long as you're passionate about what you're doing, that's really the important thing. And that drive and that passion comes through. And so it's less about checking boxes or having a specific resume. You know, we don't have a list of characteristics that people check off to be an astronaut. We're looking for people who've done exciting and interesting things, but who are really committed to their job and to what they're doing.
There must be something about resilience as well. I mean, these are incredibly difficult paths to follow, even if you're passionate about it. And the ability to pick oneself up after getting knocked down, getting rejected from a program, you know, failing in a test or some other kind of aspiration. How have you seen people work on building up their resilience and their ability to bounce back?
Yeah, this is a great topic, and it's actually something that I've really been working on. You know, the Army does a lot of this work on resilience, and so, you know, I'm going through my initial officer training, and I'm kind of listening to all these, you know, these lectures and these trainings, and I'm thinking this would be so useful for astronauts. And so we're actually, you know, thinking about putting together some programs at NASA for resilience building. You know, how do you recognize signs of stress? How do you bounce back from that? How are you going to use these tools? Really, you don't want to get to the point where somebody is broken down. You want to head that off. And so, yes, it's resilience, but it's, you know, I think about it as human performance. How can we make sure that we have the best skills to adapt to really challenging situations? And I think, you know, the Army has been at the forefront of this. They've really, you know, they have people in tough situations. They have done amazing training, and they've got amazing curriculum for this. And at NASA, you know, we stress people via experience, but we don't have a lot of formal training in resilience. And so we're actually looking at how we can take what the Defense Department has done and bring that into NASA. And again, it's a skill. It's definitely something that people can learn and practice.
Absolutely. And now, putting in another plug here for collaboration, I think it's one thing to be able to become resilient on your own, but creating that ecosystem of people that you can turn to when you have, you know, run up against a wall, whether it's somebody for support and, you know, simply an ear to listen, or if it's something far more tactical. So, you know, and I think, you know, when I'm teaching, whether it's at Harvard or in my private work, I often talk about different kinds of networks that people need to build. You know, there's the personal network for that support and advice. There's also the tactical network. Who do I need to turn to get my day-to-day work done? But that strategic network of who in my life, whether they're very close to me or a more distant contact, can I turn to when I'm absolutely trying to be as strategic as possible and pull them in at the right times. Do you think about your own contacts and relationships in different categories like that, or is it much more intuitive for you?
Yeah, I don't know that I divide things into separate networks. I think, as you mentioned, there are people that you're going to interact with in different ways. You know, if I think about within my unit, I've got people that are very similar to me working in synthetic biology and biotechnology. And those are people that I turn to when I've got a problem, you know, in that field. Because we're a small group within that unit, we're a detachment within that unit, we're also very close. And so, you know, we rely on each other to, you know, think through tough questions or figure out a problem. We're really kind of at that working level. But one of the really interesting things talking about multidisciplinary collaborations is that we have folks that are in fields like AI and machine learning, or cyber or robotics and autonomy. And so these are very different fields. But I think that's where maybe a little bit more of that tactical or the strategic network would come in. And it's great to have people that are outside of your discipline when you're trying to figure out, you know, how am I going to get things done on this multidisciplinary project? Or how, you know, talking to somebody who's got a really different perspective is a great way, kind of in a strategic thought process to figure out how you're going to accomplish your task, because you can get very siloed into the way your discipline thinks about it. And so I've relied a lot on people that I've met within the Army that are very, very different disciplines. It's, you know, can be hard to establish that initial relationship. But again, when everybody's committed to a mission, that makes it easier. And then those can be really valuable, you know, coaches, mentors, people to bounce ideas off of if you're thinking strategically.
Absolutely. And I just want to make sure I'm giving credit where it's due. A lot of this work on these different kinds of networks has been done by Professor Herminia Ibarra. She's a phenomenal researcher and professor at London Business School. And we'll put some links in the show notes for people who want to read and explore more. But Major Rubens, can we come back to this idea of kids who want to grow up to be astronauts? You were encouraging them to follow their passions. And I'd like to explore for a moment passions that are not quite so obviously related to the path that they're aspiring to. For example, there's some great research showing that people who are involved as kids or as teens in group activities, team activities, be it you know, music or theater or sports, actually develop a lot of those collaboration skills and leadership skills and followership skills that are vital. Have you seen that kind of connection with people who are able to bring transferable skills into the work?
Definitely. I think it's really important. You know, for me, I participated in all three of those things that you mentioned. I find a lot of people that I see as being really successful at both my jobs, and, you know, in my Army job and my astronaut job, they definitely have participated in group sports. I think that's incredibly useful. It teaches kids how to deal with adversity and winning and losing and being gracious to the other team. But it's something where your ability to play in a team is absolutely critical for the outcome. And so I think that helps to learn those skills and to practice those skills. I think it definitely makes you a better person when you need to function in a small team and when you do this under stress. I think the other things that you mentioned, you know, working in the theater to put on a play together, a lot of that involves, it's not something that one person can do. So it requires you to work with other people. And I think the earlier kids get involved with those kinds of skills, that's going to serve them no matter what they do.
Great. Fantastic. It's, you know, something that I think is so important for us to remember is this idea of well-rounded humans. And that goes at any age, absolutely. So I know we are coming close to the end of our show. Were there any topics that you're particularly excited about that we haven't had a chance to talk about on today's program yet?
Yeah, I want to talk about Women's History Month a little bit. You know, we talked about Women's Future Month, but really this is one of the things that the Army is celebrating is the achievements of women in the military, and not just as soldiers, but, you know, as civilians. I was a civilian working with the DOD, the family members that support people who are serving. And so kind of taking a look back and recognizing all of these historical achievements, you know, of the women soldiers and the civilians and the family members. And I think the Army is a really, it's a great place. It's a unique case study because we have people from such different backgrounds. So we bring people in from, you know, every race, class, ethnic background, and they're all coming together to serve one mission and to serve one purpose. And so I think recognizing how important women are, we're an all-volunteer force. You know, everybody's a volunteer. And so drawing on the strength, you know, of women and our female population really contributes to the diversity and the ability for the Army to move forward with our mission. And so I think, you know, we want to look forward. We want to think about all those exciting kids that are going to get involved in STEM. And then we also want to be really grateful for people that came before us.
That is fantastic. Well, Major Rubens, it has been an honor and a delight speaking with you and learning from you. Thank you so much. We wish you all the best. And I, if I can be so bold, I would love to be able to stay in touch.
Absolutely. And for folks that are listening, if anybody's interested about some of the things that I'm talking about, you can visit usar.army.mil to look up careers, or nasa.gov to look up astronaut careers.
Fantastic. Those will go in the show notes as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
At the end of every Smarter Collaboration conversation, we summarize the key takeaways. So here are a few of my thoughts today from our conversation with Major Kate Rubens, the fabulous astronaut, and so much more. And of course, I'd love to hear your thinking as well. The first idea I had to highlight is this idea of taking risks. Major Rubens was a researcher running an MIT lab as a biologist, and almost on a whim at the instigation of a colleague, tossed in an application for NASA. And you've heard her story. She then goes on to major accomplishments on the ground and in orbit. And what it sparked for me is this idea of how our colleagues, people who surround us in our collaboration network, can really give us the courage to do things out of our comfort zone. It's a conversation and a topic we come back to in a moment. This idea, though, of pushing oneself and being open to getting pushed by people around us, it doesn't happen unless we surround ourselves with high-quality, trusted colleagues. So I challenge each of you to think about who in your network would be receptive to you saying, go on, take that chance. What's the worst that could happen? Do you have people challenging you? And do you have people whom you can challenge in the most constructive ways? The idea of overcoming defensiveness, I think, is absolutely crucial. Major Rubens gave some great examples of what you need to be able to do in order to be receptive to challenge, new ideas, novelty, uncertainty, the kinds of ideas and perspectives that we ought to expect when we go into a smarter collaboration situation, when we deliberately and intentionally surround ourselves with people who are very different from us. And yet, when it happens, some of us can get our backs up. And it probably doesn't happen each and every time, but once in a while, we catch ourselves just being defensive in the moment, even though you know it's something that's good for you to hear. So what can you do? Major Rubens used the expression becoming a fish out of water. She talked about how she joined NASA as a molecular biologist. She entered the Army at a later stage in life and had a lot of adaptation and learning to do there. So I can relate to this a lot. My title here at Harvard is Distinguished Fellow at the Harvard Law School. But guess what? I'm not a lawyer. I'm a total fish out of water, surrounded by law professors and legal experts. But it's a place that I thrive because it pushes me out of my comfort zone. I've lived and worked on four continents. Trust me, I didn't feel comfortable many times living in Japan or South Africa, but those were enormous growing experiences. And what Major Rubens told us is that she helps to get herself through that level of discomfort by becoming curious, acting in ways that are both humble and interested. She'll ask lots of questions. She'll develop relationships. She'll ask people, why is it that they think something so different from her? And when she can open up those conversations, she builds the relationship, she enhances trust, and it makes her more receptive in the moment and in the future to the kinds of diverse perspectives that will allow her to continue to learn and grow and to perform higher. The last thing we'll talk about right now is highlighting this idea of a trust breach. In other words, all of us have experienced the sense of devastation when somebody whom we really trusted revealed, at least for a moment, that we couldn't. They let us down somehow, whether it was interpersonal trust and they stepped on, us, they stepped on taking credit for our ideas, they did something advertent or inadvertent, or they made a big mistake and it made us question our sense of trust in their competencies. How do you get past that? We talked to Major Rubens about it, and she was talking about making sure a real team A small group is doing the kind of work where they feel like they are on a mission. They're getting something very important done. Her example was setting up an army field hospital and making sure they knew how to evacuate people under extreme circumstances and so forth. We might not be in those sorts of life and death situations, but to overcome a trust breach, her more general point was get back in the saddle. Make sure you are doing work with that group of people with whom you need to build and rebuild trust. Give people a bit of grace. That was not a word she used, it's mine, but give people a bit of space, a bit of grace, a bit of assumption that their heart is in the right place, even if they've made some mistakes, and reinforce that you need to work together to get the mission done. So, whether we're leaders formally in a team or whether we're just assuming a leadership role in a moment of a small crisis when trust has broken down, use your power to get people refocused on what you've got in common, which is delivering something extremely high quality. So, that's a perfect example of what we always say. You can go faster alone, but you can only go further with others. That wraps today's episode of our Smarter Collaboration podcast series. Please join us next time.
We hope that you enjoyed today's space adventure with Smarter Collaboration. This show is a collaboration between Success Made to Last Productions in Austin, Texas, and GardnerandCo.co. Your executive producer is Rick Tokini, and the show was written by Dr. Heidi Gardner, Ivan Matviak, and Christine Dunn. Post-production was led by Heather Barnes and Carlo Tokini, and our operations manager is Marie Ross. This podcast can be enjoyed wherever podcasts are distributed, along with the complete show list at GardnerandCo.co and SuccessMadeToLast.com. And you can purchase Smarter Collaboration, the book, at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or any of your favorite indie bookstores. And remember, Smarter Collaboration leads to breakthrough outcomes. Have a great week.
When it comes to cancer care, every decision holds tremendous weight. St. Joseph's Health has partnered with Roswell Park, the region's only nationally designated comprehensive cancer center. Now, patients have access to advanced therapies and the expertise of leading oncologists without traveling far from home. Among the many moves you can make in the battle against cancer, choosing St. Joseph's Health can change your life for the better. Learn more at sjhsyr.org/cancer.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.